We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Summer Sports Radio 101.9 FM and Sports Radio 66 WFAN.
Well, it is a very good evening to you and AB at 8:05 and 45 seconds to go right along with it Wednesday evening on your fan, New York City. Steve Summers here, you there, unit production manager Peter Hoffman, choreographer, makeup artist Connor Green. They're on the other side of the glass. For how long? Who knows already with my kind of introductions. What is it? And what it is a 1-877-337-6666 right up until Sal Licata at 10 on your fan, New York City.
The 2-1 pitch. There's a fly ball hit out to left. Waiting is Jones. The Mets are the world champions. Gary Kuzman being mobbed. Look at this scene.
From 1969, 50 years ago, and there is a must-read out on the bookstands, as we say, and the author is with us, Wayne Coffey. And Wayne, I can't thank you enough for giving us a couple of minutes of your time.
It's entirely my pleasure, Steve. And I want to tell you, by the way, the person who's doing your makeup is just doing an outstanding job.
Well, if you were here, you would say makeup isn't going to do the trick. It's plastic surgery that might help. Let me, first of all, the name of the book is They Said It Couldn't Be Done. And I want to mention again, Wayne, that Gary Cohn reads the audio book for your book that you have written. They Said It Couldn't Be Done, and it's available everywhere you can get a book. You know,
having Gary read this, Steve, I just want to tell
you, sure.
One of the what a thrill to have him read these words. It's just, he's such an iconic broadcaster, and he was 11 years old in 69 and had, you know, has great memories of his own. So it was really, it's just a total treat for me.
Well, it's an easy read. That's number one. You're a wonderful writer. Listen, I know how to kiss Turkus already, but you deserve it. It's for a Met fan, for a New York baseball fan, for a fan of any baseball team. On a magical season, a magical team, it's a must read. Now, that's my 2 cents worth. I think anyone who is going to read the book or has read the book would certainly agree about how some of the stories, and because we just heard with Kuzman, with the last out, and with the Game 5, let me ask you this, and you have to tell the story, and I kind of teased this earlier about how the Mets got Seaver. I want you to tell that story. And how an usher at Shea Stadium helped the Mets get Kuzman.
Yeah, it's Seaver. In fact, the anniversary of the acquisition of Tom Seaver is coming up. It was appropriately enough April Fool's Day, and there were probably a lot of Met fans who thought it was a joke in 1966. But Seaver was actually a he was a very unheralded pitcher coming out of high school. In fact, as a junior in high school in Fresno, California, he did not even pitch on his high school varsity. Mm-hmm. As mind blowing as that is, he was 5'9" and 145, and you know, he was a good high school athlete. But then he ended up he put on a lot of weight. He went working at in his father's raisin packing plant, carrying big sacks of raisins, got big and strong, and ended up going to USC and started doing well. And he was in USC when the Atlanta Braves drafted him initially, and he signed a contract, but it turned out that even though Seaver had not pitched that spring for USC, they had started their season. And that made him ineligible to be drafted. So Commissioner Eckert stepped in and invalidated the signing and basically invited every major league team to put their name in the hat for the Tom Seaver sweepstakes. And only three teams did: the Phillies, the Indians, and the Mets.
Right.
And the three names went into a hat, and the commissioner picked out the New York Mets, and that was April Fool's Day, 1966.
And you can't make that up.
No, you certainly can't.
And then we'll get into so many other things, but also how they got Kuzman, how a usher at Shea Stadium may have helped or aided with the acquisition of getting Kuzman.
Now, this is even more improbable, Steve. Kuzman, forget high school. He didn't even pitch. He didn't even play baseball until he was a teenager. I talked to his older brother, Orville, and they worked on the farm together, and he said Jerry would, like, throw rocks at sparrows on the wire and throw snowballs and skip stones on the lake. But he never threw baseball until he grew into this big strapping kid, even at 13 or 14. His brother said, "I want you on my beer league team." And so Jerry's an outfielder, and his brother is a pitcher. But one day, the brother got roughed up, so he brought in another pitcher and played the outfield next to Jerry. There was a ball in the gap, and the two Kuzman brothers collided, and Orville broke his leg. And as Jerry told me when I went out to see him in Wisconsin, he said, "That's how I got my start in pitching. I broke my brother's leg." And he ended up going to enlisting in the Army, and he was assigned to Fort Bliss, Texas. And by then, he was starting to show some promise. He was the Sandy Koufax of the Minnesota Beer Leagues. But still, nobody knew who he was. And his catcher at Fort Bliss was a young man from Staten Island, I believe, named John Lucchese. And John Lucchese caught Kuzman for the first time and called his father, who was an usher at the Polo Grounds in Shea Stadium. And he said, "We have a left-handed pitcher that you guys need to check out." And this is my favorite part of the story. So he told the people in the player development, the scouting department, one of whom was Joe McDonald.
Well, he was
8 years old and still scouts for the Red Sox.
Right.
And Joe McDonald wrote a letter to Red Murph, the Mets scout in Texas, the guy who signed Nolan Ryan and Ken Boswell and some other guys. And he wrote a letter because phone calls were too expensive. So he writes a letter to Red Murph and said, "Go down to Fort Bliss and check out this guy." And Murph did, and that turned out to be Jerry Kuzman.
And Joe McDonald before, and of course everyone knows from Jody Mack, Jody McDonald, the son of Joe McDonald. And Joe McDonald in 69 was the farm director, correct?
That's right.
Yeah. And, well, let me ask you this, how the Mets almost lost Kuzman over a $50 debt. Maybe you can tell us about that.
Yeah, so Kuzman was on his way to spring training, and now he was, at the time, almost all of these guys didn't make a whole lot of money, and so they had they had off-season jobs. And Kuzman's job that year was a lineman's helper in Atlanta, where he was carrying like these big spools of wire and giving them to the guy who was climbing up the utility pole. So this is what Jerry Kuzman did. And when he was done with that work, they got into his Pontiac Catalina with four on the floor, and they went down to Homestead, Florida, and they got broadsided at a traffic light and totaled his car. And he had there were two other minor leaguers with him. Between them, they had nothing but loose change. So they had to call Joe McDonald, and he wired him $50. And Kuzman ended up having not a very good spring, and the Mets were going to release him until Joe McDonald said, "Oh my gosh, I gave this guy $50 of Mrs. Payson's money." So, and then a guy in a Mets manager in single A ball said, you know what, I'll take him on my team. And so Kuzman got a reprieve, and then he ended up, and when he found out he wasn't cut, he was going to the minor leagues, he went out to celebrate, and he overslept, and he missed the bus to Auburn, New York. And when he showed up late, the manager was not pleased with him and told him he made him run 36 wind sprints. And he said that's why he wore number 36, because he never forgot that this was his punishment for being derelict in his reporting duties.
Yeah, well, and again, another story more incredible than the by chance and by luck and good fortune how the Mets got Seaver. Without Seaver and Kuzman, there's no 69 championship team. That is for sure, with so many elements to this magical season. Let me, before we get into a little bit more, let me just, for the sake of a conversation here, Wayne, say there is a grandfather old enough to have remembered 1969, and the grandfather is sitting on a porch in a rocking chair, and he's sitting with his grandson on his knee. What does he tell his young grandson, who's maybe 10, 11, 12 years old, about the 1969 Mets? Where would that grandfather, talking to his grandchild, tell his grandchild about 69?
That's a great question. I think what the grandfather, and I, by the way, went to Game 5 when the Mets clinched against the Orioles with my grandfather. And
wow.
Please don't tell anyone, but when the ball went into Cleon Jones' glove and they won, I ran on the field with a few other people. And I got my little 4 square inches of Shea Stadium sod, and I transplanted them in the backyard.
And Game 5 with Al Weiss hitting one out.
Al Weiss, the mighty mite.
Yes.
Who had one of the best quotes of the year when people were making a fuss over a home run he hit against the Cubs. He said, "Don't call me a home run hitter. I'm not even a hitter."
Well, I mean, look at the kind of world. What did he hit, over 400 in the World Series? Is that accurate?
He did. I think he hit 455. And Clendenin even said, who was the World Series MVP, that that probably Al Weiss should have been the MVP. So, but to go back to the grandfather and the grandchild,
sure.
Steve, I think what he would say is this was just the most just magical and surreal of years. It was so unforeseen completely. People forget. I mean, the Mets were in their first 7 years. They lost 737 games. Their first year right out of the chute, they're 40-120 and 60 and a half games out of first place, and were, eliminated by Memorial Day.
And let me ask you this before we go further. And, of course, with Casey Stengel, he's managing one, and I think in that with the 62 Mets, Hobie Landreth, who was about 5'6", 5'7", was one of the catchers on the team, and they had the Richie Ashburns. Everyone knows from 1962. How was it that the New York baseball fan, seeing now with these Metropolitans after the Giants and the Dodgers had left 4 years earlier, how was it? And there wasn't the booing, was there, Wayne? I mean, there had to be because of Casey Stengel. This team was amusing.
They became so beloved, and I think you were right, Steve. It had everything to do with sort of filling the void of the Dodgers and the Giants.
Sure.
Especially the Dodgers for Met fans. Brooklyn's
sure.
right next to Queens. This
sure.
was this was just an ache in the heart that would not quit. And when the Mets were born, they were their team. These were their guys. It didn't matter whether they were. I tracked down the guys who were basically the inventors of the "Let's Go Mets" chant.
Okay,
and they started that. It was Memorial Day, 1962. The Mets were down 10-0 to Sandy Koufax and the Dodgers, and they're parading around the Polo Grounds with a white bedsheet with green paint that said "Let's Go Mets."
And I don't think there's a team in baseball even to this day who makes signs as creative and as amusing and as clever as Met fans, even to this day, Wayne.
No, I I completely agree. And people forget what a phenomenon this team was. The Yankees are obviously they're the fabled New York Yankees. But in 1969, to fast forward there, the Mets were the biggest draw in baseball by far. They were they drew almost 2.2 million fans, and the Yankees were not even half of that.
and Met fans were only willing to embrace this new team, the New York Metropolitans, with the years of losing in the 60s, of course, as a blue-collar team. They were not the Yankees. They were not the rich kids on the block. They were the team for every man, every woman, everybody.
It's absolutely true, and they were sort of the mirror image of who the working class people of Brooklyn and Queens, especially, just completely and totally embraced. And they were, you know, it's staggering to think about now, Steve, but the total payroll. I mean, I personally sort of get sick about all these crazy numbers get thrown around,
right.
You know. I love Jacob DeGrom, and he's earned it, but, I mean, the numbers are just, I mean, I think it's more than they even pay you.
The
payroll of the 69 Mets, the total payroll, 1 through 25, is $143,000. I think DeGrom's going to make that by the second inning tomorrow.
Talk to us a little bit here about, before we get back into 1969 and the magic of that season for the Mets, the research. How long did it take you to get this book together, and how many people did you get? Obviously, Tom Seaver, the news is so sad to hear about the dementia. Finally, there's going to be the statue, and of course, the family is going to be there. At the end of June, when they celebrate the 50-year anniversary. Talk to us about some of the research and how long it took you, Wayne, to put this book together.
I spent probably 2.5 years on it, Stephen, and a lot of it was I traveled around the country, everywhere from Mission Viejo, California, to see Rod Gasper, to Mobile, Alabama, to see Tommy Agee's family. Tom Agee passed very young, almost 20 years ago now. Went to Wisconsin to see Jerry Koosman. I saw J.C. Martin, Al Weiss. I saw most of the players on the team, and I also just because some of them have passed, and almost everyone in the front office has passed. I just had to rely, just sort of cast the net wider and try to get, you know, family members, people who were some reporters who are still around. The great George Vesey of the New York Times was around the Mets a lot, and he just had a treasure of great stories to tell, and Gary and Gary Cohn and Howie Rose were both wonderful.
Sure. Art Chamsky as well.
Art, I did not talk to Art Chamsky. Nope. I didn't. I tried. I reached out to him, but we just never really connected. So
why do you think?
You know, I don't know. I mean, it. You know, some guys were just not. Not open to it, I made a bunch of calls to Jerry Grody, who I you know would have loved to have talked to. He's was a real mainstay on that team,
and only recently, because there was an article with him and about him just within the last week or two, I believe, in the Daily News, your former paper. But he's been very secretive.
Yeah, he's just not. I mean, he. I talked to Ed Cranepool about this, whose locker was right next to Grody's, and he said, you know, Grody didn't even talk to him. And he's a private guy. He's not necessarily media friendly necessarily, but you know that to me, kind of telling the backstories of these guys' lives, Steve, was the real. The rich part of this journey as a writer, like for example, just to tell you about Cleon Jones, who was born and raised and still lives in the same house in a community that the local people call. Everyone always says he's from Mobile, but he's really from a place called Africa Town, which is the site of where the last slave ship ever to come to the United States dropped its illicit cargo from West Africa in 1860. And a lot of the ancestors from that slave ship are still in this community. And Cleon Jones, at 76 now, spends a lot of his days, really, either, you know, on tractors or helping people build houses. I mean, there's a lot of challenges in that community. There's a lot of poverty, but this is where he's from. This is the place he loves, and he's the greatest champion that they have. He's trying to raise funds to open a museum, a welcome center, to really honor the history of this place where this community.
And of course, everyone knows from Gil Hodges removing him from left field. That could have backfired, but Gil Hodges going out to left, and what is it? Harrelson thought that maybe Hodges was coming out to talk to him at shortstop, but here he is walking out to take out of the game Cleon Jones, and the message could have backfired. But I think Mr. Hodges got an awful lot of respect from everybody else when he did that.
He did. Nolan Ryan was on the mound. He thought he was coming to get him. And then Harrelson thought it. Ed Charles thought it at third base. Like, oh, my God, what did I do? And Hodges had such a powerful physical presence that they revered him. And to a man, I have to tell you, Steve, that every single one of these guys said that this never would have happened without Gil Hodges. The true miracle of these Mets is that Gil managed the team in a way that gave every single player on it, from the Al Weisses and J.C. Martins and Duffy Dyers right to Seaver and Koosman and Cleon Jones, they all felt important. They felt valued. They had ownership in what was going on. And he would. Duffy Dyer told me there wasn't one day where Gil Hodges wouldn't go by and, you know, ask him how he was doing, tell him, look, you're going to get in this game or that game. You know, stay fresh. We're going to need everyone on board to pull this off. And it sounds almost hokey, but he really made everyone feel included and valued. And when he went out to pull Cleon from this game, you're right, it could have backfired, but in a sense, I mean, it was, I think, a galvanizing moment.
Yep.
And Gil's wife Joan told a great story later in a broadcast interview where she said he came home that day. And she's watching the game on TV, and she cannot even believe. And Joan Hodges knew her baseball, and she could not even believe what Gil was doing. And she sees him walk like past the mound, past third base, past shortstop, out into left field. She's saying, "What on earth is going on?" So Gil comes home after the game, and she doesn't want to say anything because she knows it's the 10,000-pound elephant. She just doesn't want to, like, jump on him right away. But she has it on her face. And Gil looks at his wife, and he says, "Go ahead, ask me. I can see something's eating you." And she just said to him, "Why on earth did you do that?" And Gil Hodges told his wife, "You want the God's honest truth?" And she said, "Yes, I do." He said, "I went out there, and I walked past the mound, and I kept going, and by the time I got to the outfield, I couldn't stop." And he just went. So it was, in his mind, it was unscripted, which was very unusual for Gil Hodges, who was a tremendous planner and incredibly thoughtful and prepared. But the Mets were getting absolutely demolished by the Astros in a doubleheader, and their season really was kind of falling apart at that point in early August. And he was sort of Cleon, like, going to go in half speed after a ball, and it just, like, something sort of snapped, but it ended up being this almost transformative moment. And, you know, people forget, Steve, but as great a year as this was, the Mets were 10 games out on August 13th.
Oh, sure. Yeah, well, I was going to get to that. I want everyone to know we're talking here with Wayne Coffey. He is the author of a book out with the 1969 Mets. It's called They Said It Couldn't Be Done, and they is just about everybody until that magical 1969 season. Why do you think, by the way, and then we'll move forward, Wayne, why do you think Gil Hodges is not in the Hall of Fame?
I wish I could answer that, Steve. I think it's an outrage.
It was.
I thought that long before I started working on this book. I mean, people forget what a spectacular player he was. When he retired from the Dodgers, and actually played his last year with the Mets, of course, but he was the leading right-handed home run hitter in National League history with 370. He was a brilliant fielder.
Yeah.
He helped the Dodgers win a world championship just on the strength of that alone. And then to look at his, you know, the work that he did with the Mets and leading this team, this, you know, perennial laughingstock team that had done nothing but lose for 7 years, to the summit is, and you know, and who knows how many more the Mets would have won if he hadn't, you know, died tragically so early at the age of 47.
When do you think in that 1969 season that you began to think, and Metropolitan fans began to think, that wait just a second here, we might have something special?
I think, you know, I asked Ed Cranepool that question recently, and he said the Mets went on an 11-game winning streak against the West Coast teams in May.
Yeah, end of May, beginning of June, right?
That's right. That's right. And they used to get pounded by the West Coast teams. They won 11 straight, and all of a sudden, people are saying, "Like, what is going on here? Could these guys actually be good?" And I remember they made a big fuss over when the Mets were 36 games into the season; they were 18-18, and the writers were all. And Seaver won that game, and everyone came up to him and said, "You know, what do you? You know, isn't this great?" And Seaver said, basically, no, it's not great. We're not here to be mediocre. Let Hot Rod Caneal and the Hobie Landris, let them be happy. But, you know, we're here to compete for a championship. And so I think that was it. And with that long winning streak, they just kept on. I mean, the Cubs had a huge lead. The Cubs had all-stars and Hall of Famers all over the place. And they were just a massive favorite. But when they came to Shea Stadium, in early July, 7th, 8th, and 9th, the Mets were within, they were sort of within shouting distance now. It was, I believe, 5 games.
And they were down
3 to Ferguson Jenkins, and they rallied in the ninth inning on a hit by Cranepool. And that was the night before Tom Seaver's imperfect game, which is, you know, epic in itself. And Howie Rose said, I interviewed him for the book, and Howie called that, he just said that moment when Tom Seaver came to bat, before he came out for the top of the ninth, came to bat in the bottom of the eighth, 59,000 people in a stadium that held 55 or so. As he said, Rose is one, and it was just the most chilling moment that he had ever seen in his life, and just to honor what he had done, and it was like he called that night the night the Mets were bar mitzvahed, and I think he's absolutely right.
Well, you're talking with the Cubs with the Ferguson Jenkins, the imperfect game that was July 8 and 9 and 10, and the imperfect game was what, July 9. And if you were a Metropolitan fan then, you had to be thinking not only was Seaver something special, and then also, I mean, obviously, you're talking about that 11-game streak end of May, beginning of June. How about the Black Cat, and how many games out behind with Chicago when they came back?
Yeah, well, by then, I mean, then the Cubs were reeling. They were in free fall, and it was really because I talked to Phil Regan, the Cubs relief pitcher, and he basically said that, you know, Leo Durocher just wore everybody out. It was like a jockey who went to the whip too early. You know, he Ernie Banks was 38 that year. He played 158 games. Randy Hundley, the catcher, played 151. So I mean, the Cubs, by the end of the year, they couldn't, you know, Reagan said we couldn't catch the ball. Cubs ended the season 8-18, and the Mets, after they hit that bottom 10 games out, went 38-11. And Koosman and Seaver won 18 of their last 19 games. So
yeah.
So the Black Cat comes out and it kind of circles the on deck area where Ron Santo's standing, and Santo's thinking, "Oh Lord, can this?" And then the cat like stares right at Leo Durocher in the dugout and then disappears. So there were so many just crazy games the whole year, Steve. There was a game in August. The great Juan Marichal takes a shutout into the 14th inning.
Mm-hmm.
And on his 100, so it's 0-0 in the bottom of the 14th. It was Marichal's 151st pitch of the night.
Incredible.
100, yeah, I guess they forgot the pitch count that night.
And there was a game in the early 60s. Him and Warren Spahn both went 16 innings.
Yep. No, they had, so 151st pitch, Tommy Agee hit it over the wall. And the Mets win 1-0. The night that Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, they won a game in Montreal on Bobby Files' two-out, two-strike bunt that he did on his own. Then the Met fans will remember this, the crazy game against the Cardinals where Steve Carlton set the Major League strikeout record with 19 and lost because Ron Swoboda hit two-run homers.
Yeah, and everyone knows with Agee with the catch and Swoboda with the catch saving a game, and you are talking with Al Weiss, who had the great World Series, and yet Seaver lost game one, and then the Mets won the next four. And shocking, the baseball world, and ending a magical season. Were you there for the World Series, Wayne?
Yeah, that was for Game 5.
Game 5.
It was it was October 16th, and the day before, when Seaver was pitching, there was actually the biggest anti-war demonstration in American history.
Mm-hmm.
All over the country, protesting the Vietnam War. So, in fact, they had Tom Seaver's face picture on the leaflets they were distributing outside the stadium. So, I mean, there was so much that was going on in the world, and here was this,
sure,
you know, this charmed team that,
yep,
was. And again, if you look at the stats, Steve, you know, we're in an age now, of course, where, you know, analytics and metrics rule all.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the offensive stats of the 69 Mets,
mm-hmm,
you can't even fathom what they did. They were at the bottom of the league in almost every category. Their leading RBI guy was Agee with 76.
Mm.
They had no one with more than 26 homers. Their on-base percentage was in the low threes. And, in fact, before the World Series began, I talked to Gil Hodges Jr., who was about 17 or 18 that year,
mm-hmm,
and he was in his father's office right before Game 1 in Baltimore, and he was looking at the stats of the Orioles, who had won 109 games and had the two Robinsons and, mm-hmm, Boog Powell and Paul Blair and a pitching staff like to die for,
mm-hmm,
and he said, he looked at the Orioles stats, and then he looked at the Mets stats, and he said, "Hey, Dad, can I ask you a question?" And his father said, "Yeah, sure." And Gil Jr. said, "How are you even on the field with these guys?" And Gil stood up and went over and closed the door and looked sternly at his son and said, "I don't want to ever hear you say that again. Those statistics don't matter. There's a room full of guys out there who believe that they can do this, and that's the only thing that matters."
And speaking of numbers, Wayne, of course, Seaver threw, what was it in 69, 270-plus innings and won 25 games. And again, without Seaver and without Koosman. And the two stories about how the Metropolitans got those two guys, as you articulated before, as you alluded to, just incredible. Everyone knows from Seaver and Koosman and Tug McGraw and Cranepool and Harrelson. How about the and we mentioned with the Al Weiss, who didn't hit hardly anything during the regular season, over 400, as you told us. Of course, in the World Series. But how about the and, of course, getting Clendenin, was that not a big key? They got him from, what, the Pirates in the middle of the season?
Yeah, he was actually with the he was with the Pirates the year before.
Oh, okay.
And he came from the Expos.
Expos.
He And he was a legitimate slugger and a very talented player who's just real quickly. I mean, he's got another fascinating backstory in that he went to Morehouse College, where his big brother and mentor was Martin Luther King Jr.
Oh.
And Clendenin, the year before, of course, when Martin Luther King was assassinated in Memphis, the Pirates had more players of color than any other team. And Clendenin was, obviously, this was a terrible personal loss for him, apart from, you know, what it meant to the civil rights movement and the whole country. And he and the Pirates were the leaders in getting baseball. Baseball was going to start the season the day of Martin Luther King's funeral. And the Pirates basically were the prime movers who just said, you cannot do this. This is just wrong on every level. And they ended up delaying the start of the season. But when Clendenin came, he changed everything. He was a big presence and a very effusive presence and in the locker room and a slugger in the middle of the lineup. And the Mets had been looking for a slugger all year. In fact, they talked for most of the spring training. The GM, Johnny Murphy, was trying to get Joe Torre from the Braves. But the Braves wanted, you know, they wanted Kuzman, they wanted Nolan Ryan, they wanted Amos Otis. They were, you know, they wanted to fleece the Mets if they were going to give them Joe Torre from Brooklyn. And Torre would have been a perfect fit, but the Mets didn't want to just mortgage their whole future just by getting Joe Torre. So they held off, and they ended up getting their slugger in a trade for a couple of minor leaguers from the Expos.
Yeah, and Clendenin, certainly, what an acquisition, because he was everything you would want with the slugging and with the hitting once they got him in the middle of that 69 season. But again, we mentioned with the Tug McGraw, the Seavers, and the Kuzmans. How about with Jim McAndrew? Did he help out at all, Wayne?
Oh, my gosh. In August, with the Mets pitching, and the Mets pitching this year, this is a little how different baseball was then, Steve. The Mets had 51 complete games as a staff, and the games also took 2 hours. I actually clocked. I was telling someone last night. When I was watching the replays of the postseason games, I had a stopwatch on Kuzman who took 10 seconds between pitches. No one stepped out of the box. He got the ball back from Grody. Stepped on the mound, and when I asked him why, he said, "I could never figure nothing to do between pitches." So I just get on the mound and throw. But McAndrew was pitched the best baseball of his career. He's sort of a forgotten hero in a sense. But when the Mets were rallying, and it was really right around the time of Woodstock, the Mets looked like they were gone, and McAndrew pitched the best baseball of his life. And so did Don Cardwell down the stretch,
who was 33 years of age that year.
That's right. And so they got, and then they had a tremendous bullpen with McGraw and Ron Taylor.
Sure.
The great Ron Taylor, who was, you know, maybe was the smartest man in baseball. He had an electrical engineering degree. And then after the Mets won in 69, he went on a tour to Vietnam, and he was so really, I mean, emotionally overpowered by the devastation that he saw and the pain, seeing the injured soldiers and, you know, bodies all over the place. And just he basically at that moment committed himself to being a medical doctor. And he went to medical school started medical school at 34 and then became, of course, the Blue Jays team physician.
Well, let me just say this. I think over the course of the last 40, 45 minutes or so, obviously your research has paid off. We know the book is doing very well. We're more than happy. I can't say enough that you gave us a good 40, 45 minutes here. It really is a must-read. And your work, I mean, what you have uncovered in that book, even for a Metropolitan fan who was alive and old enough to know what was happening with the 69 Mets, we'll learn some new nuggets and insight and some of these, even as you were talking earlier about how the Mets got Seaver and Kuzman. I mean, just amazing stuff. And amazing was the key to this team with the Miracle Mets. It was the biggest upset, and certainly for anyone who was around, and you mentioned this earlier about what kind of decade it was with the assassinations, the war in Vietnam. There was so much chaos that the 1960s were all about. The New York Metropolitans were a feel-good story for the rest of the country. Take my word on that.
No, they absolutely were, yep. Steve. And I'll tell you one other little nugget that Kuzman told me. It was just, he's warming up at the bullpen before Game 5.
Yeah.
And Pearl Bailey, the legendary Pearl Bailey, is out there. She was a huge Met fan. Mm-hmm. And Kuzman, you know, was, you know, he was really hyped up. He was stressed. It's the biggest game of his life. And Pearl Bailey says, don't you worry about anything, Kuz. You got this. And she said, I see the number 8. I see the number 8. And he said, okay, Pearl, thanks for the vote. The Mets won that game 5-3. So, who knows?
Of course.
Maybe Pearl Bailey knew what she was talking about.
And here's another thing. Flushing, Queens, as you point out in your book, Flushing, Queens at the 41st latitude.
Mm-hmm.
Latitude, yep. And longitude. I mean, I'm just saying, what's in a number? Wayne, I can't thank you enough. The name of the book, of course. You want to mention with the publishing? Is that something that you want to get out?
I love my publisher and my editor, Kevin Doughton. The publisher is Crown Books, the same publisher who did Michelle Obama's book. And if I could ever catch up to Michelle Obama, I'd be a happy author.
Yes, you would.
Well, but I got a little bit of a ways to go. But no, the Crown has been great, and it was almost like reliving a childhood and a magical time, and so it was, it really transported me back to being 15 years old and just full of absolute wonder of what these guys who couldn't win somehow won.
It's a great book, and the name of it, they said it couldn't be done. The author, Wayne Coffey. The audio version of the book done by Gary Cohn. Wayne, good luck with the book. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me on, Steve. It's a pleasure.
Our pleasure for sure. And thanks to Wayne Coffey.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with autopay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without autopay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.